Proverbs chapter 31 this morning. You're familiar with this passage. As I was listening to some sermons on the way home yesterday, it was interesting how many of them were Mother's Day services taken from Proverbs chapter 31. And it's certainly appropriate for that setting. But as we've worked through the book of Proverbs, what we find today is that it's kind of a culmination. It's a climax, if you will. The wise man is finally going to get his woman. It's kind of the opposite of what one of our members used to say. She was a Marine, and I forget what he was. Was he an Army? Should the Marines always get their man? Marines always get her man. Here the man gets the woman, and he gets the right woman. The choice has been laid out before him through the entire book, and the choice is made here in Proverbs chapter 31. Let's read the entire chapter, and we'll get things rolling here this morning. Proverbs chapter 31, the words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. What, or as the ESV says, what are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed, and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to the one who's perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty, and remember their misery no more. But as for you, is the idea, verse 8, you open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. You open your mouth and judge righteously and defend the rights of the poor and the needy. Verse 10, an excellent wife, who can find? She's far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She's like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. She rises while it's yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hand, she plants a vineyard. She dresses herself with strength and makes her arm strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hand to the distaff and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. She's not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet, or it has the idea of double lining, double layers. Verse 22, she makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known among the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them. She delivers sashes to the merchant. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. When I was a young man, I was privileged to be apprenticed to a general contractor who was a Christian. His name was Ted Weinberg. And before I graduated from high school, I'd been a part of building my first house. Ted is a great guy. He's still back in Minnesota, still doing construction for a while. He gave up his contractor business in Minnesota. He sold it all out so that he could go over to South Africa and oversee all of the construction projects for ABWE and the entire continent of Africa. And so Ted sold his business, and then after several years in that, he came back and is living in the States once again. Continue using his skills for the Lord as he remodels churches and uses his talents in that arena. So that was my 16 through 24-year-old years. At the age of 22, I got married and I was living in an uncarpeted, broken-windowed apartment. And I realized that building a house is very different from building a home. And so as I had a master craftsman in my life helping me learn how to build houses, I'm thankful to God for putting other skilled craftsmen in my life to help me to learn how to build a home. I do thank the Lord that He put me into a Christian family and that He gave me a mom and a dad that lived out, not perfectly, but faithfully, what it means to pursue Christ, to be under the teaching of His Word in a faithful way, and to learn how to minister within a body that holds us accountable and pushes us forward. And it's as we come to the end of the book of Proverbs that we find this profound truth. And she's been hinting at it all along. And what we find here is that it's no longer a hint, but it becomes a picture. It comes into large relief so that it might fire our imaginations. It puts into our minds, not just into words, but on our hearts, a picture of what building a home looks like. Because wisdom finds her chief expression by constructing godly homes. And as we've looked at Lady Wisdom, we've seen that she's far from a doormat. She's an aggressive, ambitious lady who's profoundly rich and beautiful and smart and cunning and wise, industrious, never lazy, kind, generous. And this woman finds her chief avenue of expression, not primarily out on the streets after dark, like another woman in this book. She finds it by not only blooming where she's planted, but causing others to bloom as they are planted in her home. And she's cultivating a garden surrounded by the seven pillars that she's hewn out with her own hands, feasting on the slain fatted calf that she has prepared, and the table that's been set, and the banquet that goes forth from day to day. This is Lady Wisdom. And she finds expression primarily in the home. She builds godly homes. Is it any wonder then that the enemy is primarily active in destroying homes today? Is it any wonder why he would break down a one-man, one-wife-for-life construct in which this expression of wisdom finds fulfillment and changes one life at a time, one family at a time, one community at a time, one culture at a time, as this creation is brought into line with the design of God's glory. As we look at the book of Proverbs, we need a little bit of a context to understand how does Proverbs view women. The woman in Proverbs is very closely connected to the wife of Proverbs, and so this role is very intricately connected. But it doesn't speak only of wives. It speaks of women. There's some who don't find or take up that role within the community as a wife. And the book of Proverbs speaks much to all women. And it holds women up. It doesn't make them second-class citizen in God's design, in God's plan, in God's purpose for a world that brings Him glory, a community that brings Him glory. By grace, through faith, but this, let's track. How does the book of Proverbs present women in general and the wife in particular as we work through this book? What we'll find is that in Proverbs chapter 18, verse 22, is that a wife, that is, a woman who finds herself in a lifelong committed relationship,
is a rich discovery that provides tangible evidence of God's grace. It says, he who finds a wife finds a good thing. Not that the wife is a thing, but he says, when you get her, you get what's good. What's good is this relationship that is coexistent, it's lifelong, it's committed, it's a place of flourishing, of growth, it's a rich discovery. It says, and he obtains favor from the Lord. This context then is the backdrop to what we find in Proverbs chapter 5, when the father encourages his son to be in love with this woman. Understand that the context of marriage is good. It's a blessing. It's a gift. It's a tangible gift from God. And your wife is meant to be discovered and committed to while you're still young. He calls her the wife of your youth. This is when you're making this important change, because it's meant to last the entirety of your life, and it will shape the life that you begin to build together. As you watch young people grow up, there's an amazing maturation process that takes place within the first few weeks of saying, I do, and putting that ring on another person's finger. I remember when I'm living in that uncarpeted, broken window apartment, and loving my wife tremendously. Nobody ever loved a wife like I loved my wife, okay? And all of a sudden, I'm finding out she doesn't think the way I think. She doesn't do life the way that I would do life. And all of a sudden, you're finding out, you know what, I kind of like doing life the way I think I should do life. And I find out how absolutely selfish I am and how much the world absolutely revolves around me, because it's never had to revolve around anybody else. You watch young people get married and they begin to make that maturation process in leaps and bounds when they say, I do. The next step is when that child comes along, because no more can they only think of themselves. All of a sudden, they rearrange all of life to the needs of somebody whose diaper needs to be changed every few hours. Somebody who doesn't even think of controlling their burps in public. All of a sudden, they're embarrassed in ways that they never thought was possible. And their identity is embarrassingly stripped away as they give themselves to raising somebody else. The context of home is the context of humility. It's the context where you can't do life in light of self, because you're constantly challenged to do life in light of others. And you begin to build this life while young. We see that in this same chapter, the same passage, she's a potential source for continual joy and delight. He talks about her as a fountain, as a spring, as a source you can go back to time and time and time again to slake your thirst. And while he does reference or intimate the sexual enjoyment, the pleasure, it's more than that. It's the intimacy. It's the joy of being one, of doing life together, and she's there for the rest of your life. In that same passage, we see that she provides a permanent context for the lifelong discovery of what it means to do life in light of true love. He says, be satisfied, be enraptured, be intoxicated with her love. Go silly as you learn what it means to live sacrificially for her, and she learns what it means to live sacrificially for you, doing this life together. In Proverbs chapter 6, verse 26, we see that a married woman, again, this woman who's in this lifelong committed relationship, is one who hunts down a precious life, both for herself and for others. There's so much more at stake for her now that she's married. She's actively going out of her way because she's not only thinking of herself, she's thinking of a bigger picture, and she spends her time and energies searching that out. We see a little bit further in chapter 11, verse 16, that any woman, but especially a married woman, obtains honor when she's characterized by graciousness. Again, an outward flow to life, not wrapped up with self. In chapter 11, verse 22, we see that any woman's, but especially a married woman's, physical beauty is worthless if it's not coupled with discretion. He gives the little metaphor of, he says, or simile. He says, like a ring in a swine's snout is a beautiful woman who lacks discretion. And it's ugly when she's single, but it's uglier when she's married, is the idea. It's even worse when she belongs to you. Remember Proverbs chapter 9? The two women, woman folly and woman wisdom. It comes down to verse 11, or verse 12, and it says, listen, you've got to choose, and then you've got to live with the choice that you make. And now, voila. Enter the woman with the ring in her nose of a pig. Okay? That's your baby right there. Enjoy it for the rest of your life. In chapter 12, verse 4, as a wife, she has the potential to adorn her husband like a crown or to consume his bones like a cancer, like a rot, like a gangrene. This is what the wife is able to do. In chapter 14, verse 1, as a wife, she is consistently in the process of either building up her house or tearing it down with her own hands. And that's every day. This is what she does. And it's one of two things. She's either building up or she's tearing down. And it's her house that she's doing it in. In chapter 19, verse 14, we see that all of this requires a wife who seeks wisdom. So if you get a wife who seeks wisdom, what you're really getting is somebody whose life has been changed by God. That's why this good wife is a blessing from God. You don't make her like that. She doesn't make herself like that. God makes her like that, and he gives her to you. And this prudent wife who's in the process of building and searching out this precious life has been granted and gifted you by God. In Proverbs chapter 21, verse 9, the same verse is found in chapter 25, verse 4, we see that a woman who's the opposite of wise, she's quarrelsome. She doesn't listen. She's always criticizing and telling, nagging. The quarrelsome wife makes any house a prison. He said, you can have your mansion. I'd rather have a tiny corner of the housetop than to live in a sprawling house with a woman who's a nag, a woman who thinks she knows it all and trying to always change the other person without changing herself. In chapter 21, verse 19, we see that the quarrelsome wife makes all of life a desert. He said, I'd rather have nothing to eat in the wilderness than to live in a house with a contentious woman. In chapter 27, verse 15, a quarrelsome wife makes normal life wearisome, like continual dripping on a rainy day. This can change your life. Every day life, she's going to change for you forever, for the rest of your life. She's going to change how you do life. She's going to change how you think about life. She's going to change your approach to life. She's going to change your life. And then we see in Proverbs chapter 30, verses 21 through 23, that the earth itself cannot bear when a woman who is either married or and unloved, or unlovely yet married, that it works against the very structure of the universe. The earth itself cannot bear up under a woman who finds herself in a relationship where she's not loved, or being unlovely, still gets a guy with whom to do relationship. This works against the way God designed the world. And really, this is all of the references to women in the book of Proverbs. But put together, this is a big picture it's trying to paint. He's saying, listen, women have the capacity to live life like God as they listen and submit to God. And they will either be your helpmeet in living out your life for God, or they will be the biggest speed bump in your life in keeping you from accomplishing that objective. Now choose, and choose well. And we come to chapter 31 and find that that's exactly what's going to happen. When we come to chapter 31, we find one more example, one final example in the book of Proverbs, both of wisdom persuasion and of wisdom pursuit. So in verses 1 through 9, what we're going to find is wisdom persuasion. A godly mother is going to be concerned for her son, a noble son, a kingly son, and she's going to have concerns, and she's going to lay out her efforts to persuade him to wisdom. Proverbs 31, verse 1. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle, that is, the divine revelation that was spoken into his life by his mother. Verse 2. What? My son? What? Son of my womb? What? Son of my vows? And it's stated incredulously, so the ESV kind of fills in. What are you doing? I can't believe I'm finding you here. This is not how you know to live life. And what she's going to talk to him about is the fact that nothing brings you lower in life than low loves, low affections. As we begin this portion of Scripture, we find that it's addressed to King Lemuel. We don't know who King Lemuel is. He may not be an Israelite king. Jewish tradition has it that it is Solomon. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. There's nothing to support it. But for a long time, it has been held that it was. The reason is because the name Lemuel means the one who belongs to God. And we know that in Hebrew, that Solomon was also called Jedidiah, which means beloved of God. And so it may in fact be that Bathsheba is giving this oracle to her son and helping him to shape his thinking as he begins to take on the context and the robe of his father's kingliness. There's this astonishment. It's a context of love. She says, she calls him my son. What are you doing, my son? I love you. I love you too much to let you continue down the path that you're walking. It's a context of legacy. You're not just my son, but you're the son of my womb. With you goes my legacy. I've invested in you. I've trained you. I've brought you up. Is this the direction you're going to go? I've honed this arrow. I've polished this shaft. I've pulled back and I've shot you out. And are you going to be crooked? Are you going to be untrue and shank right or shank left? You can't do this to me. It's a context of responsibility. You are the son of my vows. I have prayed for you. I've given you to God. I've made promises in light of God's blessing on your life. I have a responsibility to God for you and the choices that you make. And it's the context of leadership. He's not just anybody. He's not just her son Lemuel. He's her son Lemuel, the king. And so as she's speaking to him, she's talking to him about that which destroys kings, that which is not for kings to do. Son, you can't do this. You have to remember who you are. You're not just mine, but you're theirs. This is a good place to start as we're looking at wisdom's role in the home. This is what a mom does. She says, listen, as you are learning to live out the responsibilities in your life, you reflect me, but you don't just reflect me. You have an obligation to everybody else that you find yourself in context with. You are a minister to others. She's talking to him about low loves, the affections. Then she gets to in verse 3. Don't give your strength to women. That which destroys kings. Women, plural. Flirting. Just spending your time loving multiple women. What are you doing? Don't you understand that this isn't the context of flourishing. This isn't the context of leadership. This isn't the context of integrity. Verse 4, not just women, but wine. It's not for kings, O Lemuel. It's not for kings to drink wine, to take strong drink. And as she's working on his integrity, as she's working on his intellect, she's talking to him about his affections. The women, that which destroys kings, the wine which causes him to forget revelation and pervert righteousness. And as Garrett writes on this section, he says the queen mother is concerned. Look at verse 6. Give strong drink to the one who's perishing and wine to those who are in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty. Let them remember their misery no more. So Garrett writes, the queen mother does not recommend a free beer program for the poor. He doesn't justify beer as an opiate for the masses. What he's doing here is he's making a comparison to the suffering poor and their use of alcohol, and it's meant to awaken the king to his duties and his class and his status. Listen, why do the poor, why do the destitute take up the bottle? Because they're hopeless. Because they want to forget, they want to lose touch. But you aren't there. You stand here as king. You can't touch this. Because what it does is it causes you to forget. It causes you to lose sight. It causes you to lose touch. And so as she talks to him, she says, listen, my son, nothing will bring you lower than low loves, the wrong kind of women, and the wrong kind of pleasure. But nothing will raise you higher than serving others. This purpose in life is found in the revelation that God has given. Verse 5, don't take up these low-level pleasures, verse 5, lest you drink and forget what has been decreed. Listen, God has spoken what's true, and you as a king should know this because you as a king, from Deuteronomy chapter 17, are required to, on purpose, write out the entire law in your own handwriting so that you yourself have a copy of it, so that you yourself know every part of it. You can't afford to indulge in low-level pleasures because it causes you to forget the thing that God has revealed and revealed to you in particular, that God wants you in particular to know and be responsible for. What does that include, verse 5? Lest you drink and forget what's been decreed and then end up perverting the rights of all the afflicted. If you indulge, what you're forgetting is that you have a responsibility to others. When you make life about you, you forget what life looks like for them. And so she prioritizes this as a responsibility. You need to instead, verse 8, open your mouth. That is, you need to take initiative, not to indulge yourself, to enjoy yourself, to serve yourself, but you need to take initiative and take advantage of the position in which you find yourself in order to serve as many people as possible. God's put you in a unique position. He's blessed you with unique opportunities. He's given to you unique resources. Not to make you a mini God, but to make you the highest servant in the land, to serve and reach out to the most amount of people, to do the greatest amount of good, to have the greatest amount of opportunity. So she says, open your mouth for the benefit of those who can't speak, the mute. Open your mouth for those who are destitute, those who have no hope. Open your mouth for the poor, the ones who lack income, who lack resources. Open your mouth for the needy, the ones who don't have enough to give, but have the desire or the need, their needs to be met. She says in verse 9, open your mouth and judge righteously. Son, you can't just be a king who doesn't indulge and sits there and says nothing. You've got to make decisions. These decisions are brought before you every day. You've got to open your mouth. You've got to make judgment, and you've got to do it the right way. You've got to take that initiative. You're not a little boy anymore. You can't come running to mommy and sit on my knee and let me make life's decisions for you. That's your job. You're a big boy now. And the decisions that you make will affect others. Isn't that amazing realization when you come to that point in life where you say, you know what? The decisions I make will affect others. It was that same apartment. There was no carpet. Some window panes were non-existent. It was mustard yellow. The walls were cracking. There was not a hot water heater in it. And so it was my job to install a hot water heater before I brought my bride across that threshold. It was the night before I left. My boss had promised to help me with it. He didn't show up. He was too busy. He couldn't make it. So if that thing didn't get installed, it was all my fault. If I bring my bride home to this ugly dump of an apartment, which would at least have hot water if I got this thing hooked up. But if I didn't, there'd be nothing. There'd be no comfort. There'd be no. And so I remember staying up late after a long day of work to install that hot water heater and realize, wow, you know what? If I don't do this, it's just not going to get done. I remember holding Kyle that first day when my wife's recovering from giving birth to this child, spent, and I'm holding this child, and he's got messy pants. Like, what am I going to do with this? And the thought all of a sudden goes through your mind, if I don't take care of this, nobody's going to take care of this. There's others for whom I'm now responsible, and every choice I make attends to somebody else. It's going to affect other people. And that's what his mother is saying to him here. It's noteworthy that this is her sole concern for her son. She's concerned that she lives out his opportunity to live life, to touch the greatest amount of people with the greatest amount of good. And so she says, son, you need wisdom. You can't afford to live life by default. You've got to go to revelation. You've got to go where wisdom is found. You've got to go to the source. You've got to be careful with what you love, because nothing will bring you lower than low loves. And you've got to be careful with what you do, because nothing will raise you higher than serving others. And then we come to wisdom pursuit as this noble character, a noble man, engages in the quest for the virtuous woman. And this is where we hear most of the sermons on this text. What we find in verses 10 through 31, these 22 verses, is that they're structured as an acrostic of the Hebrew alphabet, each verse starting out with the successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. I think Garrett has done a good job in helping to lay out and helping us to see that this entire poem is chiastic in nature. Chiasm is where the top and the bottom lines say things at a parallel level, and then the second and the second to last lines say things at a parallel level, and then the third and the third to last thing say something at a parallel level, until you come to that middle section, which is the point of the whole chiasm. What we're going to find in this chiasm, as it's structured, is that we're going to get down to, let's see, it's verse 23 is the center of this chiasm. Son, understand that her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. Not only do your decisions and your choices affect others, but your choice in which woman you let into your life is going to affect you. That's exactly where Proverbs chapter 9, verse 12 brought us. The choice of who you let into your life will affect you. And when you choose the right woman, guess what you become? Verse 23 is what you become. You become the man who's living out his role in the broader context of God's covenant community, making decisions among the elders, because you're respected for the wisdom that you've gained from God's word. That's where you want to find yourself. And that's where this whole chiasm is bringing the focus of this son to. It's structured as the embodiment of all wisdom teachings. In chapters 10 through chapter 30, this lady then becomes the chief bearer of the graces. She becomes the virtuous woman. We're going to look at just a minute what that means. She becomes this warlike hero who battles out life and wins life successfully by putting on the armor of God and living out the character of God. She embodies all the wisdom teachings. In fact, it's structured so that she embodies Lady Wisdom herself. I'm going to read just a paragraph of what Garrett writes. It's important for us to make this connection. She is no less than woman wisdom made real. Proverbs has, in effect, come full circle. The young man has not choice but to follow one woman or the other. He'll either pursue woman wisdom or woman folly. And with them, he'll take their counterparts, either the good wife or the prostitute or the quarrelsome wife. He cannot attain wisdom without the good wife because she creates the environment in which he can flourish. If he chooses an evil woman, he has little hope of transcending the context that she will make for him. The woman is the fitting helper of Genesis 2, verse 18, the help meet. And as such, she will either exalt or destroy her husband, and for better or worse, he will turn from his parents and cling to her. That is, he will go from the world created by his parents to the world created by his wife. And guys, you know that's exactly true. That you are who you are because of the woman that you married. Praise God. And that's what the whole admonition is here. She's meant to embody Lady Wisdom, and she's meant to draw out the reality that the choices you make shape the person that you become. Now, as she starts to lay out for her son, and as she's laying this out, this isn't just for kings. This is going to be something that anybody can attain at any level within the covenant community. But we see that she is defined by her value. She's called an excellent wife in verse 10, or a virtuous woman in the King James. She stands out above the rest. Verse 29, many have done well, but you exceed them all. She's the woman of valor. She's the warrior aristocrat. She's the one that in other contexts, specifically in the book of Judges, she's the one that's defined like the mighty man of valor. The only other place that we find this man of valor used for a woman is in the book of Ruth, chapter 3, verse 11. This is profound. This is distinct. It carries with it this warrior mentality, and it carries with it this victory that comes along with winning the battle in life. It's within reach of all. She's living out life in a roughly middle-class culture, a rather well-to-do family that's not royal, not even aristocratic, but rather reaching or attaining a level of prosperity to which any peasant farmer might attain. In fact, the picture answers to some of the aspirations of the ordinary, hard-working people whose characteristics have been traced out throughout the book of Proverbs. She's successful in real life, where real life is lived, in a really broken world. This isn't just something for kings, though. And there's some question whether this is still Lemuel's mom speaking or not. She's defined by her value as an excellent wife. She's rare. The word here in verse 10, an excellent wife, who can find? It's like finding precious jewels. The whole point is, this kind of a woman is not normal. Not normal as in weird, as in strange. The strange woman is the foreign woman to the marriage context. But there's more probability that you'll find a loose woman or a loud woman than that you'll find this virtuous woman. She's the exception to the rule. The norm is the prostitute and the quarrelsome wife. That's what most of life looks like. That's most of the options out there. But this virtuous woman, she's unique. She's different. She's a find. She's a treasure. She's like jewels, if you will. The point is not that this is an accidental stumbling upon. This is an intentional discovery. Who can discover? Because they're looking for this kind of woman. It goes back to Proverbs chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Crying out, getting up early, going to great lengths to search out for this one. And the idea here is not a once and done deal, but this is a lifelong process of drawing out. Son, when you marry her, she changes who you are, but understand it's also your responsibility to draw out what God intends her to be. Who she becomes is in large part dependent on you and who you are. So who can find this virtuous woman? Who can draw out this virtuous woman? There has to be material to work with, to start with. But what she becomes in the long haul is in part up to you. She's genuine. She's a woman who fears the Lord. In verse 30, again, we're jumping, going to jump early and late, and we'll keep kind of coming back down to the middle. She's rare. She's genuine. She fears the Lord. Why does she do what she does? Because she lives all of life in light of the reality of her God. Later on, why does she gain strength? So that she can work to the glory of God. Why does she give to the poor? So that she can give to the glory of God. Why does she clothe her house in scarlet? So she can tend them to the glory of God. Why does she speak with kindness? Because it's the glory of God that's at stake in the words that she speaks. Everything she does with God in mind. And we see in verse 31 that she's praiseworthy. This praise is earned. It's earned by her works, and it's public. It's pronounced in the gates. She's defined by her value. She's prized by her husband. In verses 11 and 12, and then up in verses 28 and 29. What we see is the people who praise her most are the people who know her best. Wonder sometimes if our wives don't have to look outside the home to find fulfillment, guys, because we're not very good at praising our wives in the roles that God's given them right in our home. But the ones who know her best are the ones who speak loudest her praise. Her husband, her children. They rise up and they call her blessed. That is, this is a result of her pursuing wisdom. She is the one who has chased down wisdom, who has listened to wisdom when it's called, who's arranged her life around a wisdom perspective. Chapters 3, verses 13 and 18. But not only does he call her blessed, he sees himself as blessed because of her. He says, listen, many have done virtuously, but you excel them all. And you belong to me. And you belong to me. I am the luckiest man in the world because you are the most beautiful woman alive, is the idea. And it's this culture that's creatively moving each other, lifting each other, helping them to move forward in their walk with God that produces this beautiful, profound, deep, rich, virtuous woman. His lips abundantly, praise her. He calls her blessed. He sees himself as blessed, but his heart fully trusts in her. Look back up in verse 11. The heart of her husband rests, trusts in her. He'll have no lack of gain. The idea of bringing him gain is the idea of bringing him the victor spoils from the war. She lives out life as though it's a battle because it is. And in battling out to do life, she comes back with the spoils of war and she adds it to his treasuries. The spoils of character. The spoils of virtue. The spoils of graciousness. The spoils of love. She brings and she dumps into his coffers. She brings him gain. She brings him good. The idea here is categorical benefit. Whatever the situation, categorically she benefits him And not just once, not just twice, not even just routinely, but always, all the days of her life. And so he seeks her out. She's prized by her husband, but she's identified by her labors. Note that she's not primarily identified in terms of the men in her life. She's not primarily identified as the daughter of. She's not even primarily identified in this context as the wife of. She's identified by her labors. But understand that these labors function as fruits, not roots. They become what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7. By their fruits you shall what? You shall know them. Okay? How do I know that she has character? Well, look at the way she's living her life. Look at verse 13. She seeks out wool in the animal kingdom, flax in the plant kingdom. She knows how to use both kingdoms and works willingly, or she works pleasurably with her hands. She's industrious. She goes out like the ships of the merchant and gathers and brings her food from afar. Verse 15, she rises well as yet night, provides food for her household, portions for her maiden. She's diligent. She's detailed. She considers a field and buys it. With her fruit of her hand, she plants and invests a vineyard. She dresses with strength, makes her arms strong. She's industrious. She's diligent. She's detailed. She's financially astute. She's strong. She's busy. All of these things are what she's doing. And they don't give her identity. They reveal her identity, is the idea here. So it's not doing so as to become. It's being, and therefore doing, is the idea of this context. And so as she works out this character, it evidences what's going on in her heart. She's described then by her effect. Well, verse 27 is the counterpart to this on the other side of the chiasm. She looks well to the ways of her household and doesn't eat the bread of idleness. She's never lazy. She's always doing something to benefit somebody else. What about her me time? You know what? That's a construct of a luxurious, selfish American culture. What about me time? What about me time? When has life ever been about you? She tends her soul before a living God who gives her the strength that she needs to live life in light of Him and others. And she cultivates that perspective humbly, busily, always. We see, as a little bit later, she's described by her affections, verses 20 and 26. Her affections include the poor and the needy. It includes, up in verse 26, wisdom and kindness. Why is this what defines her? Well, go back to chapter 3, verse 3. Because she does not let steadfast love and faithfulness forsake her. She's bound them around her neck. She's written them on the table of her heart. And because she has taken the attributes of God, the steadfast love of God, the faithfulness of God, and written them into her life, written them onto her heart, she's able to think of others and give them what they need. Whether it's meeting their needs with a meal, and it talks about her hands actually doing the giving, doing the work so that she can do the giving, or giving them from her mouth the wisdom and instruction that they need. We see that she's described by her affections, but she's not defined by her fears. Verse 21a, she's not afraid of the season. She's not afraid of the winter. She's not afraid of the snow for her household. Verse 25, she's not afraid of the time to come. She's not afraid of the future. This isn't a fearful, timid woman. What am I going to do if? What if? You know what? I've thought ahead. I've made preparations. And there's things that are out of my control. You know what? It's okay. I've got a husband who loves me and loves God. I've got a God who loves me and my husband. Things are going to be okay. Do I know what it's going to look like? No. Am I concerned? A little bit. Am I afraid? Absolutely not. 'Tis grace hath brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. That's where she lives life. Could she be afraid? She could. You know what? She has real estate that she's purchased. She's got vineyards that she's planted. She's got merchants that are waiting for her goods. She's living a busy and productive life. There's a lot that could go wrong. But is she worried about it? Nope. Because she knows her God's in control. She's not defined by her fears. She's stylized by her clothes. I didn't know what word to put here, but when you think of clothes, you think of style. She's characterized by her clothes. Just look at how this passage talks about the clothing that she wears. Verse 21. Her household is clothed in scarlet. Or the idea is a double layers. But it has the idea of more than necessary, going above and beyond. Verse 25, strength and dignity is what she clothes herself in. Verse 22, she clothes herself with linen and purple. She's intentional in her relationships, her private relationships and her public relationships. She's making sashes and girdles, I think the King James calls it, and making sure that the merchants have what they need in order to sell. And she's doing things publicly. She's interacting with the culture in which she lives. She's also, verse 22, making bed coverings for herself. The idea here is the language is similar to Proverbs chapter 7, verse 16. What the prostitute propositions the young man with. Just listen, I've made bed coverings for myself. And the idea is she works as hard as the prostitute to allure her husband behind closed doors. She makes her bed ready. She makes her body ready. Verse 22, the idea of being clothed with linen and purple is the idea of dressing herself richly. The idea of linen coming from Egypt, the purple coming from the Phoenician dye. She's taking care of her body in that she's putting on something other than sweatpants and a t-shirt. She's making herself look good for her man. She takes care of her body in making her arms strong. She's regulating how she takes care of her body so that she doesn't just get flat and flabby and lazy. She's taking care of herself for others so she can serve. Again, what you see is a woman who is not primarily thinking about self, other than how she can minister to others. One last thing that we see is that she is identified with her husband. There in verse 23, you come to the middle. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders, the wise ones of the land. So as we come to the end of the book of Proverbs, we need to be reminded that wisdom's chief expression is in constructing godly homes. The choices that you make, whether you listen to God and pursue wisdom, pursue His grace, pursue His character, pursue His holiness, take His reproof, accept His love, it's going to make a difference. It's going to make a difference from your home outward. It's going to affect your children. It's going to affect your community. It's going to affect beyond even that to this creation in which you find yourself. Wisdom is woven into life, but life is done at home. So as you wrap up this summer, as you wrap up this book of Proverbs, what we find is that wisdom always points us to God, and it's always expressed in Jesus. Wisdom has to bring us to Him. And as we choose wisdom, we find that we're coupled with something that's going to change us forever. But not only does it change us, we tend to reflect back on the wisdom that we live. You know, people are taking their idea of God from us and the way that we live out our lives. And that's not an incidental part of the book of Proverbs. That people are taking their cues about your God from the way you live your life. There's a lot at stake. Let's pray.